I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. I remember trying a so-called meatless meat product, I can't really call it food, some 40 years ago, and honestly, it tasted like shoe leather with a similar texture. It was completely inedible. A few weeks ago, I was at a nephew's wedding where they served a vegan menu, and the meatless meat was surprisingly delicious. Last week at KFC in Atlanta introduced a plant-based item called Beyond Fried Chicken, and the customers who stood in line to try it gobbled it up. In fact, the franchise sold out in 5 hours. So clearly there is a growing interest, even demand, for food that doesn't require slaughtering an animal. Now, vegans and vegetarians make up a tiny portion of the population, so brands like Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat are appealing to meat lovers, hoping to lure them away from eating animals by mimicking the taste and texture of those foods. So today on Radio Times, the future of meat, from meat substitutes to lab-grown meat. Also, some of the legal battles over words like meat and burger and how our diets affect the climate and also animal welfare. Joining us are Jan Dukovic. He's the Connie Kaplan postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, and he studies the politics and ethics of industrial food production in the United States. Joining us by telephone. Jan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks a lot. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Kelsey Piper. She joins us from the studios of the Sports Line in San Francisco. She's a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect. She's been covering the meat alternative industry. Kelsey Piper, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here.
Kelsey, let me begin with you, and we can even begin with the KFC in Atlanta that got a fair amount of attention. You wrote about it. What do you think explains this demand for meatless meat?
So I think in the last year, a lot of people have become aware of meatless meat, when previously it wasn't something they'd heard of, or they'd heard of veggie burgers, but they expected those don't taste very good, and they're only for people who are avoiding meat on purpose for some reason. And in the last year, there's been a lot more awareness that there are some great products on the market that taste uncannily like meat. And a lot of people are really curious, a lot of people want to give it a shot, and a lot of people are more than curious. They're eager to give up meat if they can do that without sacrificing the flavors they love and the restaurants they love. So when a chain like KFC goes for a meatless chicken product, you have a ton of enthusiasm, and that's what we saw in Atlanta.
Indeed. Jan, how do you see this?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Kelsey. Look, I think that there's been a shift change in how people see issues around animal welfare and animal ethics, and people are very aware of a number of environmental crises we're facing. And I think people, on balance, want to do something about it, but being asked to go vegan or make a drastic lifestyle change, I think, puts some people off, puts them on the defensive. So I think that the genius of companies like Beyond and Impossible is that they've tried to give people something as close to an analog as possible, saying, look, the switching cost is really low, this is delicious, and we're eating this burger, you'd probably already eat a burger, no one's asking you to go vegan. But you're also doing something good. And I think that people are willing to pay, you know, the extra 50 cents, extra $1 at Burger King to make that switch. And so I think a lot of it has to do with both a change in mainstream opinion about environmental issues and animal welfare, and simultaneously the very smart and very aggressive marketing by companies like Impossible to Beyond to market not to vegans, not to market in the health, you know, the health food section of the supermarket, but to market to meat, to meat eaters, to flexitarians, and to get their products in the meat aisle.
Have you tried
competing directly with meat?
Jan, have you tried these products?
I have. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, a big fan as a vegetarian or as a.
Yeah, I'm a vegan. I'm a long time vegan, and I came through eating, you know, tofu and seitan and tempeh and all the, and so I suppose first generation meat alternatives like tofurkey and corn, and I still really enjoy those products, but I'm definitely a convert to Beyond and Impossible.
Kelsey, have you tried this food?
I have, yeah. I actually made my family tacos with Beyond Ground Beef just last night.
And what was the response?
Lots of enthusiasm. I'm a vegetarian, so I might not know how exactly it tastes like beef, but a lot of my family is not, and they're sold. Beyond just substitutes really well for ground beef in recipes like tacos enchiladas, lots of the uses you have at home for ground beef. Beyond Beef is a perfect substitute.
I'm looking at what's in Beyond Beef, and I'll just read. I'll just read it here. It's got water, pea protein isolate, expeller press canola oil, refined coconut oil, then 2% or less of cellulose from bamboo, methyl cellulose, potato starch, natural flavor, maltodextrin, yeast extract, salt, sunflower oil, vegetable glycerin, dried yeast, gum arabic, citrus extract, ascorbic acid, beet juice extract, I'm almost done, acetic acid, succinic acid, modified food starch, and something called annatto for color. I think the question, Kelsey, is this healthy?
Yeah, so that's definitely a question that a lot of people have started asking as these products have gone mainstream. I think that Beyond and Impossible are meant to be very similar to meat in their nutritional profile. They're not a salad. They're made of plants, but that doesn't make them health food. But I'm not too worried about the long ingredients list. Part of that is you can make a long ingredients list for an apple if you separate out all of the chemicals. You're not required to do that by the FDA if it's all occurs naturally in one product, but you absolutely could. And then another part of it is if each of those things are individually fine and you can look them up, you can say, what is beet juice? Am I okay with eating beet juice? What is vitamin C? Am I okay with vitamin C in my food? Then, you know, having a lot of them at once isn't particularly a health concern.
Yeah, and it's interesting that a lot of these fast food companies have gotten in on the act. Tyson Foods, other, you know, really large, what we often call as big food, getting in on this whole meatless meat, chickenless chicken, porkless pork, turkeyless turkey. What do you make of that? Is it just dollar signs?
Absolutely. Look, all of these companies exist to make a profit. And so I think for a long time, they weren't sure. If you're a large company, you operate within a large value chain, you require a large amount of inputs, you require suppliers who can supply a large amount of food. And I think committing, so for instance, Burger King committing to carrying the Impossible Burger is a really major business decision. And I think for a long time, these companies were testing the waters. They felt perhaps threatened by these new products, or alternatively, they just thought these products were a passing fad. And I think when they started realizing that this wasn't a passing fad, they're increasingly willing to take chances to stock these products, right? And the fact of the matter is the North American food value chain really depends on economies of scale production and large-scale economies of scale distribution and consumption. And so I think that, yeah, I mean, big food is the way you change the food system in this country, which a lot of people might not want to hear. But if you look at how most Americans consume and the fact that Americans are used to, relatively speaking, paying quite little for their food as a percentage of household incomes, then the way to really change the food system is to get at most Americans where they're already consuming. Right? Which I think explains why it's really hard to convince people to go vegan or change their dietary practices, whereas it's proven relatively quickly to be relatively easy to convince people to switch to, let's say, Impossible or Beyond, if you're offering it to them at the supermarkets they already shop at the restaurants they already eat at.
Because people want convenience and they want something that's has a kind of a track record. It's interesting, Jan. I think the typical American consumes something like 200 pounds of meat per year. Do I have that right, do you think?
Yeah, it's I think it's 222 at last count.
At last count. So in order to have a direct impact, I guess, on the environment and on the sort of welfare of animals, these kind of meatless products are going to have to really scale up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So global demand for meat is going up. And in the United States, demand for meat is also going up, albeit far less slowly than, let's say, in China or some parts of Southeast Asia. But people don't seem willing to stop eating meat. And we know that meat is an environment or mass produced, so factory farmed, industrially produced meat is an absolute environmental nightmare. And it goes from the fact that animal agriculture globally is responsible for about 14% of greenhouse gas emissions. We kill just under 10 billion animals in this country every single year. Most of them raised in conditions that most people would consider very inhumane. Right. There are, of course, questions of widespread exploitation and abuse of labor. There are many questions of environmental degradation, be it through groundwater contamination or be it through a nuisance in rural communities. So we're talking here about odors and effluent. So it's really an environmental disaster. But this, what the system has done is it's trained Americans to consume a large quantity of cheap meat. So factory farming not only produces factory farmed animals, it produces a consumer for factory farmed goods. And to change that consumer's habits is extremely difficult. And people do make decisions primarily on taste and habit. And price, of course.
Of course. And Kelsey, I think so much of meat production in this country is really out of sight, out of mind. So we don't visit slaughterhouses. We don't really get to visit these factory farms where, you know, animals are kept in these really inhumane conditions.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people, I think, are under a bunch of misapprehensions about the process by which meat is produced in this country. A lot of things will slap a humane label on there, or a grass-fed label on there, or say they were free-range, when in fact those animals didn't have access to the outdoors, they were dosed with tons of antibiotics to keep them from getting sick in the crowded conditions, they were mutilated, there's videos of them just being tortured, and what happens is 99% of animals are raised on these factory farms. It's almost all animals are raised on factory farms. If you get meat, you're getting it from a factory farm. So I think people aren't really okay with that. People don't want that at all. But if you're buying meat that comes from animals, right now you just don't have a good option to avoid that.
So even when you go to the supermarket and it says, you know, humanely raised and no use of antibiotics, so it sounds like what you're saying, Kelsey, is don't believe what you read there?
Yeah, a lot of those labels are meaningless or a very small concession, you know, 10,000 chickens in a box with like a little porch that only 5 of them can fit on at a time, and they get to claim the chickens have access to the outdoors. You know, there are a couple of humane labels, and we've written about this a little bit at Vox, that have higher standards that might make a difference, but for the most part, it is impossible to just go to the store and buy meat that was treated in a way that the average American consumer finds acceptable. It's just not available. What you have is factory farmed meat. And I don't think people are okay with that. But until recently, they didn't have a good option if they wanted something as nutritious, as tasty, and as cheap as meat.
And what are those humane labels? Do you have them ready at your fingertips? Otherwise, we can post them later.
Yeah, I can post them for you later.
Okay, fair enough. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Kelsey Piper. She's a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect, has been covering the meat alternative industry. Jan Dukovic is the Connie Kaplan Postdoctoral Fellow in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. As I mentioned earlier, he studies the politics and ethics of industrial food production in the United States, and we are talking about what is happening to our food and the alternative to meats. We're going to take a very short break. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I posted this on our Facebook yesterday. We got a lot of response. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. It turns out meatless burgers, sausages, and nuggets aren't just for vegetarians and vegans anymore. New products are being marketed to meat lovers as well. We're talking about the future of meat and meat substitutes with our guests, Kelsey Piper and Jan Dukovic, and with you. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kelsey, I just wanted to ask you something. This has to do with the Impossible Burger, which actually, as I understand it, when you cut into it, bleeds. I guess I'm using quotation marks around that. It bleeds, and it uses something called HEME, heme. What is that?
Yes, so heme is the thing that makes meat taste bloody. It gives it that sort of distinctive iron taste that people associate with it. And it's also what makes meat sort of bleed on the grill. And heme is released when a protein in meat is heated. And the Impossible Burger wanted to replicate that, but you can only get the particular protein that they use from meat. So what they did is they developed yeast that creates a similar protein that, like meat does, releases heme when it's heated. And that's just gone through the final steps of FDA approval and demonstrated that it's safe for everybody. And so now they have meat that bleeds. It's kind of incredible what modern food science can get up to.
I will say so. Let me go to you, Jan, and I'm just curious about, I guess, cellular agriculture?
Yes. Well, so that's a really gigantic question.
Yes, I realize.
So cellular agriculture is a technology which allows stem cells to be extracted from an animal and then in a lab setting, so in vitro, fed a medium, so a medium that involves proteins and sugars, and that urges the cells the muscle cells or fat cells to replicate as if they were inside an animal's body, but of course with no animal being involved. And so people have been talking about this technology for a long time, but it was just in 2013 that we actually had the first prototype, so the first lab-grown burger, which was done by Professor Mark Post from Maastricht University in the Netherlands, who is now the CEO of Mosa Meats, which is one of the startups in the cellular agriculture space. So the promise of cellular agriculture, which is entirely promissory right now, so we don't quite know if this technology can be scaled and made cheap enough to actually compete with meat. So despite that big question mark hanging over everything, so the promise of cellular agriculture is that it is meat. So it's a complete analog, biologically speaking, for the meat people eat. And so the idea being that if we can produce cellular meat at scale in a way that's cost competitive with conventionally raised meat, then you're not actually asking consumers to switch to a plant-based burger. You're asking consumers to keep consuming exactly what they're already consuming, which is meat, but meat that's produced differently. And so if this technology bears fruit, then we're theoretically looking at the complete obsolescence of large-scale animal farming.
That's incredible. I mean, it is then meat without having to slaughter an animal, correct?
Exactly.
Kelsey, how much in the distance is this new technology?
So I think that, unfortunately, this is still a ways away from hitting store shelves. And it's a really exciting concept, and it definitely seems like a crucial step in ending animal agriculture is having these perfect replacements. But there's a bunch of challenges. It's very hard to get something that holds together with sort of the sophisticated textures and sophisticated tissue patterns that you get in, say, a steak. It's much easier to do something like ground beef, where we don't care too much about, like, the structure. And we haven't really gotten that figured out yet. And then there's a bunch of other technical challenges, from what the best medium for cells to grow in is to how to get it cost effective. I don't think those are impossible. I think that what we can do with technology grows every year and can be pretty incredible. But I do see it as a ways away.
I'm looking at some articles about this KFC in Atlanta, which did sell out of their nuggets within something like 5 hours. But I also read that in certain ways, chicken nuggets are easier to sell than a lot of other products because it's more like the breading than the actual meat. Can you speak to that, Kelsey?
So I definitely think that some forms of meat are easier to replace than others. And yeah, chicken nuggets are an example of something that's pretty easy to replace because the chicken is mostly just compressed there to make a flavorful center to the nugget. Ground beef, easy to replace. A steak, that's hard to replace. A chicken drumstick, that's hard to replace. And we'll get there someday, but those are definitely much more complicated foods. Luckily, a lot of meat served in the United States is these processed things like nuggets and ground beef, so just replacing that would be a huge step forward for the environment, for animal rights, for sustainable farming.
You agree with that, Jan?
I would agree. I also think that the important thing to note with cellular agriculture, if we go beyond these products we're talking about, is that there's a capacity with this technology to replace virtually anything that comes from an animal, and there are already companies working on this. And so here we're talking about fish, so you have companies like Finless Foods or Blue Nalu, which are trying to replicate fish, which would also address not just factory farming, it would address overfishing. Many of our fish stocks are severely overfished, severely depleted. Apex predators like bluefin tuna are being pushed towards extinction, and the closer they are to extinction, the more expensive their meat becomes. So if we can address fishing, and in theory it's actually easier to replicate fish muscle cells than mammal muscle cells, so we have that. We have the potential to replicate leather without cows being killed, replicate silk, replicate horseshoe crab blood, which is used in a lot of medicine, and also dairy. So you have companies like Perfect Day out of the Bay Area, which can use something called acellular agriculture.
A meaning without?
Yeah. So if you're making cellular meat, you start with a biopsy of an animal cell. So you start with a base stem cell from an animal, and then you feed it the medium, and it grows and expands. With acellular agriculture, you can grow proteins that are analogous to, let's say, a milk protein or a milk caseinate protein, but you can do it using, for instance, a combination of yeasts. So Perfect Day can have milk, which is identical to actual milk, but it's de facto a vegan product. This is how dairy works. This is how egg whites work. In theory, this is how a number of other products that are currently derived from animals would work. And so I'm with Kelsey that this technology is still not quite there. It's more hype than reality right now. But the applications are far-reaching, and I think they go far beyond chicken nuggets and burgers.
Interesting. Kelsey, I'm wondering, though, the criticism of GMO foods is something we've discussed on this show. I mean, there are many people that feel like GMO foods are perfectly fine, but will this, do you think, fall into the same criticism and debate and argument?
So I know that this is something that the makers of Beyond and Impossible Foods have been very conscious of. And, you know, personally, my review of the research is that GMO foods are safe and it's fine to have GMO foods. But being conscious of that, I think they've gone to a lot of lengths to avoid that. And, like, Beyond contains no GMO ingredients. And the Impossible Burger, heme is not itself a GMO. It's a protein that occurs in meat. But the yeast that produces it is genetically modified, so that makes people go, well, does that count or not? And I think the best answer is that GMO foods are actually just safe.
That's Kelsey Piper. She's a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect. She's been covering the meat alternative industry, which is what we're talking about today on Radio Times. Jan Dutkiewicz is a doctoral fellow in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, and he's been looking at the politics and ethics of industrial food production in the U.S., and big food is getting into meatless burgers in a very big way. Again, you can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to get to this whole linguistic debate, but here's a question from Paul. He says, I've tried both the Morningstar brand, the Beyond Meat, and the Burger King Impossible Whopper. Only question, do they have complete protein as required by human beings? And Kelsey, if I can toss that back to you.
So yes, both Beyond and Impossible have worked pretty hard to make sure that they're getting you the same complete proteins as you'd get from meat, and they're doing that.
I wonder, though, Jan, whether these more, I should say, maybe laboratory-created foods are going to put, you know, the burgers that are made of black beans and grains and veggies, whether they're going to put them out of business.
I think that's an entirely empirical question. I mean, who knows? I, as a longtime vegan, I'm not necessarily drawn to, for instance, cellular agriculture. I'm not even that drawn. I mean, I won't actively seek out Impossible or Beyond Burgers because I'm used to the taste of seitan. I enjoy seitan. I enjoy beans. I enjoy legumes, right? So I think that there is room in the market for a wide variety of tastes and products, but I also think that the success of Beyond and the success of Impossible is pushing companies like, let's say, Tofurky, to really invest in R&D and to really improve their product, as competition is wont to do. And so I think what you're actually going to see on the market is not just dominance by Beyond and Impossible, but a wide variety of brands offering a wide variety of taste profiles for a wide variety of tastes.
It's so interesting.
At least that would be my hope. But I think, yeah, it's sort of like the quinoa and mushed bean burger on the way out. It may be, or it may just be relegated back to the health food aisle where it started.
Which is interesting. And here we are talking about, you know, meatless meat and turkeyless turkey. And Kelsey, there is a whole linguistic debate going on about what is meat? What can you call meat? What can you call milk? What can you call sausage? Help us understand, I guess, what's at play here.
Yes, yeah, so a number of states have passed laws that are sort of targeting these new meatless meat products and also, incidentally, targeting lots of existing products that have been on the market for a long time, like tofurkey. So Missouri passed a law like this. Mississippi passed a law like this. Arkansas passed a law like this. And these are very broad, very vague laws that prohibit labeling a product with a term that has historically been used to describe a meat product if your product is not made from slaughtered animals. So you can see that that's targeted very squarely at these companies. So if they say, this is the Impossible Burger, then that's prohibited under these laws because the word burger has historically been used to refer to a beef product. This is almost certainly unconstitutional. Under free speech rights, corporations are allowed to use non-misleading advertising that describes their products. But those cases are slowly winding their way through the courts.
And it's interesting, the ACLU obviously gotten in on the act because of some of the speech issues at stake here, Kelsey.
Yes, the ACLU was very much involved in the fight to allow companies to advertise their products. So federal consumer protection laws prohibit misleading advertising. If anybody were able to demonstrate that the Impossible Burger confuses consumers and they think it's beef, then the FDA could move on Impossible and make them change their labeling and marketing. But people aren't confused about this. People are seeking out these products specifically because they know they're not meat and they're intrigued by that. There just aren't signs that consumers are confused by the Impossible Burger, by the Beyond Burger, certainly by tofurkey or something like that. So these laws aren't really protecting consumers. They're really protecting an industry. They're protecting slaughtered meat because this competition makes slaughtered meat producers nervous.
Well, Jan, let me go back to you because you look at the industrial food production in this country. What has been the response of cattle ranchers and I mean, it's interesting Tyson Foods is getting in on this, but nonetheless, do they see this as a threat?
Right, that's a very good question, and I think what we need to do is disambiguate between this notion of the meat industry as if it were this whole and look at it more at its constituent parts, and specifically at the relationship between producers, who are the ranchers, and the people who actually own, be it chicken facilities or pig facilities, and processors, which are the companies like Tyson or Smithfield that take care of the slaughter of the animals and then turn that into a product that they sell down the value chain to retailers and to restaurants. So what these new products have done is they've really clearly showed a schism in the economic and political interests of processors on the one hand and producers on the other. So all of these laws, so for instance, the law in Missouri, the number of other laws, I believe they're in over 20 states, similar laws are being tabled now. Those are all being pushed by groups like the U.S. Cattlemen's Association or state-level cattlemen's associations. So these are producers, so the people who actually produce the animals, digging in their heels because they see a massive threat to their industry and to their market. And so, which is why these laws are being sent in so quickly. They're not based on model legislation. The wording on many is very poor. It's really a knee-jerk reaction. And I think it's very telling that you're not seeing processors, so you're not seeing the Tysons and the Cargills of the world get involved in these lawsuits. In fact, Tyson and Smithfield are launching their own plant-based products. Tyson has an entire venture arm through which it's investing in cellular agriculture startups. Because if you're like, if you put yourself in the shoes of the CEO of Tyson Foods,
sure,
it is not in his interest to factory farm and slaughter animals en masse. It's in his interest to sell affordable, good-tasting protein to his consumers. And if that protein comes from plant-based alternatives or it comes from cellular agriculture, and it still makes sense economically, then that's what that company will do. And so I think the real threat is to ranchers and to the actual animal producers. And the processors, I think, are being far more agnostic, and they're playing the field to see what happens and to see if these products have staying power.
Well, and it shows all these various divisions within food production. But, Jan, do you imagine cattle farmers being put out of business?
I think down the line, if these products succeed, yes, I think cattle farmers or cattle farming would be pushed to the margins, right? Cattle farming is already a deeply problematic industry for a number of reasons, but it's also an industry, farmers are aging, right? People don't necessarily want to work on farms, and that's part of a whole demographic and cultural shift away from the rural to the urban, which is problematic for a number of reasons.
Sure.
But I think that, yes, that cattle ranching could, in theory, be made, for the most part, obsolete or be pushed towards something more like small-scale regenerative agriculture, which would lead to, which is on the one hand more ecologically sound than mass-scale production, but on the other hand would lead to far more expensive products.
Sure, indeed. Kelsey, let me go back to you. It takes something like 10 calories of food to make 1 calorie of meat. So in terms of just calories, it's a very inefficient way to get those calories.
Yeah, and, you know, this comes up a lot in conversations about why vegetarian and veganism are better for the environment, as people say, well, you're still growing plants, and that still has an impact on the environment. And it absolutely does, but you have to grow 10 times as many plants if you're going to then feed them to animals and get meat that we then eat, compared to if you directly eat the plants. So by eating things that are made from plants or things we make ourselves in a factory, we can just have a much lower impact and a much lower environmental footprint.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about things like meatless burgers, chickenless nuggets. They are being marketed not just to vegetarians and vegans anymore, but to meat eaters. The idea that in order to address the problems of factory farms and slaughterhouses and, frankly, climate change, we need to get off our meat-based diet. We're talking with Kelsey Piper. She's a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect. Also with us, Jan Dukovic, and he's a doctoral fellow in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. He wrote a book called Capitalist Pigs not so long ago. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times. Here on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Again, talking with Jan Dukovic and Kelsey Piper about meatless meat, chickenless chicken, and the various products that are on the market being sold in many ways by fast food chains, hoping to appeal to carnivores to get them to give up their meat-eating ways. Jan, let me put Michael Pollan's mantra. He's been a guest on the show. He's been a guest, I think, on probably everybody's show, talking about food and food politics. His mantra has been, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. How does that figure into our conversation?
So I agree with Michael Pollan on this. There are many things I don't agree with Michael Pollan about, but I agree with that. And from a public health perspective, for instance, people should be eating less fast food, less meat, more greens. These are absolutely desirable things that people should be doing. But the fact of the matter is that people do not. If you compare this Michael Pollan's ideal, which is also in many ways my ideal,
sure,
to actual behavior, you see a massive disconnect. And so people seem not willing to adopt that mantra. And so if they're not willing to adopt that mantra, it doesn't mean we should stop trying to convince them. But we should also try to, if possible, reduce the environmental and animal welfare impact of the actions that they are actually undertaking. So I think these things aren't necessarily, these don't align, as Kelsey said earlier, an Impossible Burger or Beyond Burger, it's not the same as a bag of spinach. It's not a health food product.
Right.
What it is a far less impactful alternative or analog. So do I think that, so I suppose in answer to your question, I have two answers, which is number one, should we ideally replace meat with these products if people are going to continue eating meat in large quantities? And the answer is yes. But the second question is, should people eat less meat and less meat analogs and switch towards a more plant-based diet, both for their health and for ecological sustainability? The answer is also yes.
Kelsey, let me go back to you. I'm thinking about that KFC in Atlanta that sold out their Beyond Fried Chicken in about 5 hours. I guess the question is, when it gets introduced again, will they come back? Will they want a second helping?
Yeah, that's very much the question that all of these fast food chains are thinking about. Is this a fad where people will try it out once, or is this a sustainable new product line that will drive people to our restaurant over and over? And I think Burger King was one of the first big chains to do a huge launch of the Impossible Whopper back this spring, and they've expanded that out since to all their franchises and are keeping it on the menu, which I think is indicative that they're seeing it not as a one-time PR stunt, but as something that consistently drives people to their restaurant and something that their regular customers like and will order.
And I guess the question, and maybe this is fine, is that they'll have their meatless hamburger, Kelsey, with their French fries and their soda. I mean, you know, it's not exactly the most healthy diet in the world.
Yeah, and an Impossible Whopper with fries and a soda is absolutely not health food, and you wouldn't want anybody thinking otherwise. But it's much better for the world than the equivalent deal with meat. And it does get you the same nutrition that you can get from beef. And I think that's, you're trying to balance a lot of things in a plant-based burger. You want it to be nutritious. You want it to be cheap. You want it to taste like meat. I think that they're doing a really good job of balancing those things, but mm-hmm. they're certainly not also creating something that's as good for you as a salad. Maybe someday.
Maybe someday. Here's a comment from Jim. It's heartening to see vegan options becoming more available. Maybe someday humanity will move beyond the horrors of slaughterhouses and factory farms. But I get the feeling, Jan, is that vegetarians and vegans are excited about this stuff. But, I mean, the real test, the real challenge is, will carnivores who want to have their burger, their steak, will they sign up for this stuff?
That is absolutely the question. And I think that this is, as I mentioned earlier, I think this is a lot of the genius behind Beyond and Impossible's advertising, because they're being very aggressive in going after the, they're going after the meat aisle, they're going after the carnivore. And I think it's working. So from the little we know, these are all, of course, empirical questions, but from the little we know, we see that this is working. So Burger King sales in Q3 have gone up by, I believe, 6%. And people are willing to give the Impossible Whopper a chance. They're willing to spend a little bit more money on it. And so, but it's really an empirical question as to whether mm-hmm. people continue purchasing these products, as to whether these products expand, as to whether perhaps down the line cellular agriculture arrives and people can make the switch to that. So, I mean, seemingly there is demand, right? And
yeah,
as long
clearly.
As there's demand and it comes from meat eaters, then that's positive. Will factory farming be made obsolete is entirely an empirical question that's in the hands of consumers.
A question for Diana. Do plant-based products have preservatives in them more than regular meat? Can you answer that, Kelsey?
So that depends a lot on the specific meat product. Something like that you get from Burger King or McDonald's, the meat products are also going to have a lot of preservatives in them. Same thing for many meat products sold in grocery stores. You can get meat products sold without any preservatives, and right now you can't get Beyond or Impossible products sold without any preservatives. Mm-hmm. But I think you need to be more specific than comparing to meat, because there's a lot of stuff out there packaged and sold as meat.
Well, and I find it interesting. I named all the various fast food chains that are getting in on the act, but McDonald's is not there. Kelsey, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that what I see McDonald's doing is sort of watching the situation very closely, trying to figure out, is this a fad? Is this for real? Do we need to be offering this in order to retain our customer base? Is always the question on the minds of people making these decisions. And once they're persuaded that this isn't going away, and once Impossible and Beyond can produce enough burgers to meet McDonald's demand, that's the other half of this equation, because both of those companies are sort of at their limits with the current crazy rise in demand for their products, then I think we'll see a McDonald's deal. And that'll be another sign that people in the industry are perceiving this not as a fad, but as a transition in the way we eat.
But you're saying something important, Kelsey, when it comes to just the sort of business of providing food to people. If there is demand for a particular product, you better have it there for that customer, correct?
Yes, and this has been a big challenge for both Beyond and Impossible this year, is they have so much demand, and demand has been increasing so fast that they are really struggling to keep these products on store shelves and keep these products supplied to their restaurant partners. And both of them have recently signed deals with new production companies that can help them produce enough burgers and enough ground beef and enough sausage to meet demand. And I think over time, that sort of process will smooth out. They will get better at producing at the massive scales that there's currently demand for. But in the meantime, I kind of wonder if McDonald's is holding back in part because they're just not sure that anybody can sell them enough burgers, because McDonald's is a huge company.
It sure is. You want to weigh in on that, Jan?
No, I think Kelsey has it. She has it absolutely right. I think for McDonald's to roll out a product in all of its restaurant that is both regularly available and profitable for McDonald's, they need to make sure, A, that customers are going to walk through the door and order that product regularly, and B, they need to make sure that there are no hiccups in the value chain. So I think they're playing the field. And I think that what McDonald's has the luxury of doing is seeing how well this goes. How well is Burger King doing? Is this going to be sustainable for Burger King? Is demand not going to drop off? And when the time comes, if McDonald's were to enter this space, I think it would be, at the risk of overstating it, I think it would be game-changing, because it would normalize plant-based products in the public imaginary.
But
if you can go to any McDonald's and get an Impossible Burger or a Beyond Burger, I think that would well and truly mean that these products have arrived.
It's interesting, as the world gets wealthier, the demand for meat grows. There seems to be a kind of a relationship there, Jan. And talk about scaling up. Do you think it's possible to scale up to meet a global demand?
Absolutely. I think, well, for one, this scaling up wouldn't be, we're not just talking about Impossible and Beyond. There are startups in Europe that are doing these products. There are startups and companies throughout Asia that are making these products. There are startups in Australia, New Zealand, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that the capacity is there to replace virtually all conventionally grown meat with plant-based products, as long as the consumer demand exists. If we're talking just about raw inputs, the raw inputs necessary to make these products are all readily available. I mean, we're talking peas, we're talking soy, we're talking wheat. So it's not like we're reinventing the wheel, other than things like, for instance, the artificial heme that Impossible uses. So absolutely, all the tools are there. And these products also, the more R&D is done and the more companies emerge, the better these products will become in terms of using new ingredients, improving taste, improving the nutritional profile. These products are far more malleable than meat. There's only so much you can do to change or improve, let's say, a burger, a meat burger. But with these products, there's really a lot of space for maneuvering, right? So I absolutely think that it's possible to meet global demand with these products, as long as consumers demand them.
Kelsey, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I think that ultimately, if you want to solve something like climate change, you need global solutions. You can't do anything that's just a U.S. solution.
And I wonder. Go ahead.
And that means that you've got to figure out how to offer these things worldwide to everybody who wants them.
I think the fires in the Amazon, related to some degree to clearing the land for cattle, has Kelsey raised the interesting concern that carnivores and others have about where our food comes from. Kelsey?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. You know, people see the Amazon burning and they learn that a lot of that is for cattle ranching, and it really makes them go, wow, am I contributing to that? Am I fueling that? And actually, if you're in the U.S., you're probably not getting beef from the Amazon, because there are other food safety concerns there. But certainly, if we were able worldwide to replace a lot of the demand for beef, we would be able to do a lot to reduce fires like that, to reduce environmental degradation like that.
Because let me toss a comment from Phyllis. She says, your guest was saying that GMOs are safe, but there is research that suggests this might not be the case. As I said, we have done whole hours on this particular topic. But anything you want to say just briefly back to Phyllis?
Yeah, I think that there is certainly a lot of research in this area, and it's always hard to sort of dig in and go, which of these studies do I find persuasive, which do I find unpersuasive? I don't feel like the studies that raise concerns about GMOs are very carefully conducted. There's one exception to this. Sometimes we use genetically modified crops so that we can spray them with more pesticides, and then the pesticides can absolutely be harmful to human health. So I think that particular category is something where there are very real health concerns. But that's not a very analogous category to what's going on with the Impossible Foods, and I'm not worried about the sort of yeast that is used in Impossible Foods. I haven't seen any indications that that poses health risks.
Jan, is there any, and we've been talking about all the upsides, but are there any downsides to these meat substitutes?
Well, I think it depends on what you see as a downside. So the first point, of course, is the public health question. As I said before, I think it's far preferable for people to move towards a truly plant-based diet. So these products aren't necessarily, they're not necessarily all that much healthier. So there's the public health downside of people just continuing to engage in not very helpful behavior. The second question, of course, is the question of political economic shift in terms of locations of production and the type of labor required to produce these goods.
Right.
So it's quite possible that if these goods do take off, and this is the case for plant-based products, but especially for cellular agriculture, is we'd be seeing a disruption in labor, especially rural labor in animal production and slaughterhouses and that part of the value chain. As labor moves, be it to factories producing something like Impossible Burgers and Beyond Burgers, or to research and development on the technological side of this. And so I've written about this. I recently wrote an article in Jacobin about this, arguing that something like a Green New Deal or a just transition should involve not just federal funding for these type of products, but also job retraining and reskilling to amortize the potential job losses of people who might be displaced by changing production in the meat sector.
Going from the sort of rural parts of the country to could be in a city like Philadelphia, right?
Absolutely. Well, it depends, because products like the Impossible Burger and Beyond, they still use real agricultural inputs, right? So wheat, soy, peas, et cetera, et cetera. But they use far less of them, and there's no labor necessary, of course, to raise animals, to kill animals, et cetera, et cetera. But with cellular agriculture, if that technology takes off, then you're cutting out a large part of the rural value chain, and absolutely, you could see all of Philadelphia being fed by meat produced in something resembling more a brewery than a lab that could be located in West Philly.
Interesting. Kelsey, final question to you. It's really men who drive this demand for meat. Is there a kind of marketing to men in particular that you see out there?
So I do want to note that men eat more meat than women, and women are more likely to be vegetarian or vegan, but both men and women are very unlikely to be vegetarian or vegan. Vegetarians and vegans make up, by most estimates, like 1-3% of the population. So you really got to address everybody. I do think that there's some reluctance among men sometimes to take on this new health food or anything that's marketed as, you know, primarily as a socially conscious choice or an environmentalist choice or a health food choice. You know, I think there's some cultural reluctance there. But that's why it's so essential to just market products as really tasty, really nutritious, and good for the world. And I think if that's your message, it absolutely resonates with everybody. Certainly lots and lots of the people in line at KFC were men. Certainly a lot of the people who are excitedly tracking the rise of plant-based meats are men. I think you can get everyone.
Well, Kelsey Piper, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. She's a staff writer for Vox's Future Perfect. Jan Dukovic, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. He's the Connie Kaplan Postdoctoral Fellow in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, with help today from Xavier Lopez. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thank you so much for joining us.